Welcome to the Journalism of Everything podcast. I am your host and freelance journalist, Doree Smith. And today we are going to be talking about the Department of Education. What is it? What does it do? Why does it make some people really mad? I spoke to Barbara Hoblitzell, who was the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Higher Education within the Office of Legislation and Congressional Affairs at the Department of Education up until a couple of weeks ago. I figured I would ask questions right at the source. But to get started, let's talk a little bit about what's been going on with the Department of Education and, you know, kind of a little bit of a backstory. So if you've been paying attention some, you will know that the Trump administration wants to completely eradicate the Department of Education. And recently, it cut the workforce by 50%. In fact, when President Trump recommended Linda McMahon for the head of the Department of Education, he said he wanted her to do such a good job with cuts that she'd put herself out of a job. Now, this targeting of the department by Republicans in particular is not new, though the more overt tactics that they're using are. The Department of Education has actually been under attack since its official inception as a department in 1979 when Jimmy Carter signed it into law. The Department of Education has its roots in political controversy because it is an example of the great debate about the role of federal government. It sort of was created way back in 1867 during the Reconstruction, but the department was quickly downgraded to an Office of Education within the Department of Interior. At the time, the states were very concerned with any federal overreach, especially when it came to educating its populace. Mostly, its job was to collect statistics and then offer guidance according to those statistics. Now, the Cold War actually spurred much more federal interest in education, especially when Russia launched Sputnik in 1957, the big space race. Who's going to do what first? Congress passed the National Defense Education Act in 1958, and that was to improve science, math, and language education. Got to beat the Russians. That was the attitude. In 1965, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, and that was a cornerstone on his war of poverty. It brought a lot of federal funding to public schools, especially those in low-income communities. On October 17th, 1970, President Jimmy Carter signed legislation that created the Department of Education as a cabinet-level agency. So that was a big step. The Department of Education began its operations on May 4th, 1980. Now, President Carter had a few objectives with creating the Department of Education. One, he wanted to centralize and coordinate federal education efforts. And two, he wanted to raise the status of education policy. So this act was backed by teachers' unions such as the National Education Association or the NEA. And of course, right from the beginning, conservatives criticized it because they thought that it gave the federal government too much influence in local schools. Now, President Reagan tried to, because Jimmy Carter lost the election and Reagan took over. Reagan tried to eliminate the department, but he was unsuccessful. There was not enough bipartisan support for it. In 2001, President George W. Bush, a Republican, signed the No Child Left Behind Act, and that greatly expanded federal oversight through testing and accountability. Now, there's been a lot of criticism of this act in particular, as far as how much it emphasizes testing. So that's a whole other thing we could get into. There's so many components of this. I could do a whole series, but for sure, I know No Child Left Behind has been greatly criticized for that. In 2015, President Obama replaced No Child Left Behind with Every Student Succeeds Act, and this gave more flexibility back to the state. So politicians have been back and forth on the Department of Education for eons, but there are a few main criticisms. And the reason I want to go through the criticisms right now is because later when I talk to Barbara, we're going to talk about what the Department of Education does. So one criticism is that the Department of Education is federal overreach and that education should be controlled by states and local communities. National policies cannot count for local needs and cultural differences. A second criticism is that the department spends billions of dollars, yet doesn't produce significant academic improvement. Often federal funds often come with strings attached that burden schools with compliance rather than innovation in education. I see this criticism a lot on social media, there's a stat out there, we were number one in the world, and then the Department of Education was created, and now we're way far below. The problem is I haven't found a lot of substantiation for that stat in particular, but I'm sure there are other measures that could be used. It's complicated. Okay, number three. National education policies like No Child Left Behind often use standardized tests and rigid metrics that don't reflect real learning or student potential. And this is a common thing in education. I know there's lots of testing, and it certainly doesn't always test the right things, but that is a common complaint that I've seen. All right, a fourth criticism is that the department has exacerbated the student debt crisis and distorted the higher education market. Federal student aid has inflated college tuition, and loan forgiveness programs are mismanaged or are unfair. And I don't think, and Barbara will talk to us a lot about this, I don't think a lot of people realize how much aid is given as far as grants by the Department of Education for higher education. That is something I honestly wasn't aware of. I sort of thought of it as a K-12 thing. So that's interesting. And again, it's very complicated, but that's another criticism. And then the fifth criticism, major one I saw, was that the department promotes ideological agendas under the guise of education policy. Barbara and I are going to talk about this too. I will introduce her after a brief musical interlude.
For today's episode, I wanted to go right to the source about what the Department of Education does. It is a hot topic right now, and I wanted to talk to an expert. I interviewed Barbara Haublitzel, who was the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Higher Education within the Office of Legislation and Congressional Affairs at the Department of Education up until about 2 weeks ago. I'm going to let her talk about her extensive experience in both government and nonprofit sectors. And then we're going to talk about the things that the Department of Education does and does not do. Hope you enjoy our discussion. All right. Well, let me get into it then. So I want to make sure I pronounce your name properly. It's Barbara Haublitzel.
Haublitzel.
Haublitzel. Okay. Just wanted to make sure. And you most recently were the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Higher Education within the Office of Legislation and Congressional Affairs at the Department of Education.
That's correct.
All right. I took it straight from your words on LinkedIn. So it's a good source. Well, tell me just briefly about how long were you with the Department of Education, and then what was your role there?
Sure. So I spent about a little more than 10 years at the Department of Education. I started out in the Office of Post-Secondary Education, where I was responsible for promulgating regulations to implement various programs that were appropriated and authorized by Congress. And then at the beginning of the Biden administration, I moved to the Office of Legislation and Congressional Affairs, where I was responsible for acting in more of a liaison role with Congress and primarily the authorizing committees that work on Department of Education issues. So the Senate Help Committee and the House Education and Workforce Committee, and then the appropriators.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's amazing. I when I started doing research for this episode, I started looking into all of the different components of the Department of Education. And I just, you know, made my head spin a little bit. It does a lot.
Yeah.
Wow. And so you were with the Department of Education, you said, for about 10 years. What was your experience before then?
So before that, I spent a number of years working for the University of California, both on the Berkeley campus and then at the system-wide office of the president, and primarily in student services roles, so admissions, financial aid, other student support facing operations. And then I worked for a time as a consultant to college and university presidents and their cabinets, helping them to improve the way in which they provided services to students.
Oh, great. Wow. That's great. All right. So there is so much misinformation about what the Department of Education does. In your words, what does the Department of Education do? And we'll get more into specifics, sure. But yeah.
Well, primarily the Department of Education is responsible for distributing grant funding that has been authorized by Congress to states and to students, states for K-12 education, students in higher education, so Pell grants, SEOG grants, things like that, teacher preparation programs. There's also a primary responsibility for ensuring the civil rights of students are protected. So that's a huge responsibility of the institution, both in terms of ensuring Title VI and Title IX compliance for students. And then there is a regulatory responsibility. So ensuring that various laws are translated into implementing regulations that can be followed by those responsible for those programs. So whether it's regulations for K-12 programs or for students with disabilities or higher education programs.
And what is Title VI and Title? Well, I know what Title IX is, but Title VI and Title IX, what are those?
With discrimination primarily.
Okay.
So it's discrimination based on race, gender, religious affiliation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, gotcha. Even like disabilities, is that part of that or is that a different
piece of it?
Okay.
Although students with disabilities are protected under a number of different provisions, but yes.
Okay, gotcha. I have a child with an IEP, with a speech delay, a delay that turned into a stutter. And so I didn't realize that was something that's, you know, kind of covered by the Department of Education, that he would be guaranteed that. Yeah.
Significant role in supporting basically school districts in terms of ensuring that students with IEPs or other disabilities are provided access and affordability and opportunities to succeed in the classroom.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, my child is quite extroverted and talkative. And I always say it is just the cruelest thing to have a child like that have to also overcome a stutter, but he does great at it. He's got a good attitude. So what are, and this is going to be a lot, I'm sure, but what are some programs that are at risk with the reduction currently in the Department of Education?
Well, so from a staffing perspective, I think everything across the board is at risk because there's been such significant cuts to staffing. This is particularly true in the Office of Civil Rights. The number of civil rights cases per office will increase exponentially, and there was already a significant delay in ensuring that those cases were adjudicated efficiently and effectively. So the reduction in forces there are going to be significant. On the higher education side, of course, everything regarding the provision of federal student aid has the potential to be at risk. Support for borrowers in repayment is obviously a huge concern, and one where a lot of the work is outsourced to contractors, but those contractors need to be overseen and guided by career staff in the organization. So the fact that they're not there is significant. But coincident with the reduction in force was also a reduction in some of the grant funding. So some of the longitudinal studies being conducted by the Institute for Education Sciences are now either canceled or at risk. We're also seeing some of the teacher preparation programs. The grant funding for those is also being held up. So I think it remains to be seen what the long-term impacts will be from these cuts and from the reorganization of the Department of Education at large. But I think that there's a general lack of understanding of the vital role the department serves and the need for those staff to ensure that those programs are kept up.
Right. And that is one thing I think I didn't realize is how much the Department of Education oversees or I guess for the higher education grants, like you mentioned the Pell Grant, but there's lots of other bits of financing, correct? That
right. So there's that work study, there's the Supplemental Education Opportunity Grant, the TEACH grants, and then, you know, there are programs for folks in graduate school, so the Fulbright grant, some of the International Foreign Language Institute grants. There's a number of things that happen that assure that we have the best and the brightest here in the United States, which is a commitment that taxpayers have made and Congress has fulfilled, and that now is being put at risk.
Oh, I didn't realize the Fulbright was part of that.
Fulbright generally is run through the State Department, but there are elements of Fulbright that come through the Department of Education.
Okay, gotcha. I actually applied for one and then COVID happened. And I wanted to study. I graduated from Davidson College back in 2000, but found myself as a stay-at-home mom wanting some more education in journalism. So I went to UC Irvine because they have a bachelor's in literary journalism. And I applied for a Fulbright to study the Yazidis, who are a people, ethnic minority in northern Iraq. But they actually, a lot of them have ended up in Germany since, because they've been displaced. Yeah, so there's a whole program for that. But COVID happened, so that's okay. But it was really exciting, you know, that you could say, this is what I want to study. And, you know, wonderful. So this is something to debunk that I am sure you have had to before, or at least go into. Does the Department of Education dictate educational policy to the states?
Well, policy is an interesting concept because certain policies, yes.
Yeah.
They're set through statute in Congress, and it is the department's job to ensure that they are being carried out. So they have an oversight role. But curriculum and what is actually taught in classrooms is definitely not the purview of the Department of Education. In fact, we are forbidden from dictating curriculum. So I think one of the big misnomers and certainly a current talking point is that the Department of Education is telling states what to teach. And in fact, that is not the case.
Interesting. Do you think that, now as far as like civil, because civil rights is definitely something under attack, it seems, in the country. Do you think that maybe is there any sort of, because there's civil rights, the Department of Education is ensuring some sort of civil rights or certain rights are led. Do you think that's being misinterpreted as, well, this is policy, or I don't know?
No. I mean, it's an interesting question. So Title IX obviously is a very controversial piece of statute. How it is regulated and how it is implemented, excuse me, by various administrations has changed. So certainly under the Obama administration and under the Biden-Harris administration, there was an interest in expanding Title IX to ensure greater protections for students who may have different gender identities or who may have experienced sexual assault on campus, things of that nature. The Trump administration, both during the first term and now again in the second term, views the Title IX protections very differently. They want to restrict the protections that are provided to transgender students or to LGBTQ students. They also want to provide greater protection to those who are accused of sexual assault versus those who are victims of sexual assault. So a lot of it is open to political interpretation, which creates problems.
Right. Yeah, I guess in the first term, I don't remember, and maybe it's just because it was a while ago. I don't remember such an attack on one, the Department of Education, and then civil liberties. You know, what are some changes that you saw?
During the first term, Secretary DeVos was very interested in the protections provided for those who had been accused of sexual assault. And that was really her primary focus around Title IX. She felt that particularly young men in college were being sort of indiscriminately and unfairly accused, and it was denying them some of their due process rights. She wanted to assure that they had a more active role in the adjudication of these kinds of claims. That obviously was highly controversial and at odds with the Violence Against Women Act and some other concerns that were held across the government. Some changes were made to the Title IX regulations at the time in order to accommodate her perspective, but they were later changed by the Biden administration.
Okay, gotcha. And now is this Trump administration trying to reverse it, or is he trying to make it even more? Working in government. It's always always a swing. Interesting. Well, what were some other differences, or I guess policy changes that you saw? Because I guess you were in the with the Department of Education when DeVos was the right. So I guess, do you see a significant change between now and then?
Number of changes that were made from the Biden or from the Obama administration to the first Trump administration, changes were made to in the higher ed space to regulations that pertain to borrower defense, to gainful employment, basically consumer protections for students and borrowers. Those were later overturned by the Biden administration, and I expect will again be relitigated now under Trump 2.0.
Okay, gotcha. Well, of course, with this last round, or I mean, really, Department of Education was cut by what was it, 50%? The force. You know, what workers are left? Does there seem to be any sort of precision to these firings, like certain parts of the department that are affected, or?
So the messaging from the political leadership is that the determinations regarding the reductions in force were strategic. But when queried, especially by congressional staff, about specifically those massive cuts to the Office of Civil Rights, and whether or not the caseload prior to the cuts and the caseload after the cuts were reflective of some kind of a strategic decision, the political leadership was unable to answer that question. So that seems to suggest that perhaps less strategic, less well informed. They did occur, you know, I think 3 days subsequent to Secretary McMahon's confirmation. So perhaps she hadn't been terribly involved in analyzing the data to determine who should be cut. A number of staff left through various incentive programs leading up to the reductions in force. So again, I don't think there had been time for the organization to really take stock of who's here, who's able to take on the work, who's able to do some of these tasks that are so vitally important. And then based on the fact that people left, other people decided to leave because they were like, I can't leave my organization any longer because I don't have adequate staff to do that. And there's a hiring freeze in place. And so.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I know that's so tricky because I'm sure federal workers, wherever, in whatever department you were in, were like, okay, well, this is, you know, this is going to be interesting and having to get ready for that. But then just the way it was done seemed very speedy, you know, that makes it difficult to, to make, you know, to line something up for yourself, you know, after that happens, I mean, what is the job market like for, I know it obviously depends on what someone does, but are there like a lot of nonprofits that you think would have room for someone who's worked for the Department of Education for any amount of time, or is this just going to be a tough?
I do think that, you know, just looking across the federal workforce at large and the number of federal workers who have been displaced recently, there's no way that the job market in this area is going to accommodate all of them.
Yeah.
Certainly some effort is being made to try to address those concerns. I know Governor Wes Moore in Maryland has said, you know, he's opening up teaching positions with waivers of some of the certification processes that are typically required for teachers for former federal employees, and looking at other state opportunities for federal employees. But I think that there's going to be a significant number of very, very talented people who are going to find themselves without work. The things about nonprofits is that they often rely very heavily upon funding from the federal government. And so as those grants are cut, their ability to hire is cut. Johns Hopkins University here in Baltimore had to lay off 5,000 staff because of cuts to their grant programs.
That's a lot.
Depending from the federal government. So, you know, some of those places that would become natural employers of former federal employees are also feeling the pain of some of these decisions.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that, but wow, that's a chunk. That's a very big chunk. Wow. Well, I want to go back real quick to, so it seems, I don't know, I guess this is just my brain. I'm looking at, there's kind of like the K-12 responsibility, and then there's the higher education responsibility. And I think a lot of people are probably very concerned with the K-12 and how that's going to be affected. Now, some states receive a lot more funding than others, you know, in that in particular, K-12. Like, I think I read or this is just the school system, the Detroit public school system, I think takes 45% or something like that of its funding through the Department of Education.
Right.
Yeah.
Probably Title I schools.
Yeah. Yeah. Which makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So let's say that somehow the department is completely cut, which seems to be the goal. I'm not sure of the reality, but that seems to be the goal.
Executive order, certainly.
Yeah. What is going to be the impact on, let's say, the top 10 school districts that, you know, take the most money, you know, or benefit the most from the Department of Education funding?
Well, I mean, I think the intention would be that the funding would go in the form of a block grant to the state, but that would then require that they have the mechanism, the staffing, the processes in place to make determinations about how that block grant is then distributed to the various local education entities in their state. And then the other piece of it that would be missing is the oversight and accountability, which currently the Department of Education provides. So you would be asking them to both be the recipient of the fund or the funds, the distributor of the funds, and then the one to audit those funds. So a bit of a conflict of interest there.
Yeah.
But I think that more than anything, the states lack the resources in order to really administer these programs. And the programs themselves don't include funding for overhead. So they would have to do that funding themselves.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think about that. Yeah, I guess that is the political argument that this should be a state's, you know, the state should be determining these things and not the federal government. Certainly, probably a lot more to it than that, but that seems to be the idea. I mean, is that, you know, again, let's say that the Department of Education eventually is eradicated. Do you think that's actually the goal, to put it to the states, or is there, I don't know, is there something else, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to try to ascertain. I think there's certainly in the higher education space, I think there is interest in asserting a lot more government control over colleges and universities. I mean, certainly what we've seen with Columbia University and trying to say that certain academic programs should be put in federal receivership, very unusual, never heard of such a thing, but beginning to try to interfere with sort of academic freedom and, you know, free speech under the guise of protecting against anti-Semitism. So there's a number of things that I think could potentially change the education landscape at large. I think we're going to see, if these changes continue, that it will be harder to recruit and retain quality faculty and staff, researchers. We'll see a decline in the number of Nobel laureates at our universities. We'll see a decline in the number of foreign students who come to the United States to study. And we may see a decrease in the number of US students who continue to enroll in our institutions. They may choose to enroll in institutions elsewhere. So.
Right. Yeah. I think as Americans, we do need to realize that there's a lot of very good universities abroad, you know.
And I mean, one of the things that has always been sort of a hallmark of the U.S. public education system, and certainly our private institutions as well, is the research capabilities. And the federal government has largely deferred research to the universities and funded a lot of that research. But as funding gets pulled back and those research opportunities are ended, I'm not certain that the federal government is in a position to necessarily replicate those efforts. And so currently we're diminishing the number of federal staff at the NIH and other places.
Right.
We will have a hard time if we shut down research on both ends.
Yeah, that makes sense. I remember, I was in the Army for 7 years and I deployed to Iraq, which is why I'm interested in that part of the world. And I remember I had an odd job where I worked for the Koreans in the Kurdish part of the country, the northern part. And part of what they were doing, the Koreans were there building hospitals and schools, mostly K-12, kind of their, you know, to build up that part of the country. So I would go to these meetings with the ministry, you know, the ministers of education, and they would be talking to the Koreans, and both of them were so proud that they had sent their children to America to study.
Yeah.
And I just remember being a little shocked, honestly, because South Korea has great education, and you know, certainly in Iraq at that time, there weren't maybe what you would imagine, but there were plenty of opportunities in the region. And I just was like, wow. Oh, wow. Really? You know? And so it would be sad to lose that sense of pride besides all the other, like you mentioned, the research lost and the talent that, you know, that we draw and create ourselves, you know? Yeah, that makes me sad, but we'll see. So another sort of thing, and this is again on the K-12 side, a lot of people are saying, okay, well, if we give control to the states over, let's say, students with disabilities, you know, their education, some states will just not want to do it at all. Other states will, I think probably California, we feel relatively confident in that. Is that an exaggeration, do you think, or do you think that's...
I mean, one of the impetus for forming the Department of Education is that when responsibility for students with disabilities was housed under HHS, or what was then HEW, students with disabilities didn't get as much attention as they deserved. It wasn't a significant consideration. So I think that, you know, there's definitely something to be said for ensuring that there is somebody at the federal level who's taking that very seriously. Now, whether or not that could be replicated in another federal agency remains to be seen, but it needs to be a priority. I mean, I think one thing that works in favor of students with disabilities right now is that Senator Cassidy, who leads the Senate Health Committee, is very invested in ensuring services for students with dyslexia. Just a tip of the iceberg for students.
It is.
But it is something he pays attention to. So, you know, hopefully folks will continue to lean on him and ensure that those students' rights are protected.
Yeah, I didn't realize that, but that's interesting, because I think, again, a lot of people think if you don't have a child with a disability, I think, and I'm in this boat as well, or I was, that you think that you're talking about disabilities, you're moderately to severely disability, you know, and those children are absolutely should get an education as well. And I have many friends who are in special education, but there's also kids who have dyslexia, have ADHD, is usually covered by an IEP. And those are, you know, it's not, doesn't have to be this whole thing. It could just be accommodations for testing or whatever, you know. I had My son, I don't think, has ADHD, but he is a very wiggly boy. And he had a second grade teacher that would let all the boys just spin in their chairs.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, she was brilliant. She was a boy mom, so she knew. And I just remember thinking, oh, well, that's wonderful. There needs to be some sort of accommodations, and it could be small, and it could be more extensive for sure. But yeah, if no one's looking out for that, might not happen, you know. That's interesting. What was the name of the senator again? Cassidy?
Cassidy. Yeah.
Cassidy. Okay. I'll look that up for sure. All right. Well, what have I not covered, Barbara, that you would like to make sure I get in there?
I really think that's, you know, you've hit on the primary ones. I mean, it's funding, it's institutional research, it's ensuring access and affordability. I think the biggest risk to public education, given some of the changes that have been proposed, is that states will have the decision to make potentially whether they continue to support public education in the same way. And I think that, you know, that's the scary thought, to think that somebody may decide that actually our state would be better served by having all private charter schools or all, you know, parochial schools or something other than public schools. And it could happen.
Yeah, that's scary, because right now everyone is entitled to an education in this country, but we could see that going away. That's sad. That's very sad. Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your very intelligent, you know, education on this. And, you know, I'm wishing you the absolute best with whatever you decide to do after this. Thank you so much. Have a good day. When we moved to California in 2014, our son was 2 years old and he could speak, but he was not understandable. He chattered away all of the time, but he had an obvious speech delay. After just one visit to the pediatrician, we had a referral, and soon a speech therapist came to our house for 1 hour once a week until he turned three, and then he attended a nearby speech therapy preschool. I think it was twice a week for a few hours at a time. It was really cool. The theory for speech therapy in particular, and a lot of other disabilities like that, is that early intervention is key. And boy, did he get it. And this also meant, since he went to the preschool, when he started kindergarten, he already had an IEP. It was written out. It had goals. And to this day, he still has an IEP, and he gets speech therapy services at school. And he's had it his entire school career. I have a friend who had a son who had some really significant learning disabilities. And for him to receive any kind of IEP or services, she had to go into mama bear mode. And she had to jump through tons of hoops, and it still took months for her to get him something. Every year, she has to continue to fight for him to get what he needs. So why the discrepancy, when his disabilities were more severe than my son's? The state. I live in California, which seems to be more proactive with these things. And she lived in North Carolina, which apparently is not. There are lots of arguments for and against the Department of Education. And at the crux of it it seems, that the states should have control over their own educational policies. This is a solid conservative idea, but I think there is an issue overall with equity. Let's say that the state of California invests in an education for students with special needs and that the state of Mississippi does not. And when I say special needs, kind of like what I talked about with Barbara, it doesn't mean you have a moderate to severe, disability of some sort, although that's also very important. But I think what people don't realize is that ADHD, which is a pretty common childhood disorder, is considered, a disability that can receive services in school. Dyslexia, there's a lot of things that are covered under that. So these children will grow up to be adults, and one set will have more opportunities than the other just because of where they live in our supposedly United States of America. This would be one thing if each state was not part of a union and in fact was its own country, but that's not the case. We are much farther away in time and conditions from the United States, where states' rights was an integral argument. We have a much larger population. We have economies that are much more nationally and globally intertwined. And I mean, I think we should be united in at least a basic level of human rights. And why would education not be part of that? Now, I've heard a few arguments that say that some of the things that the Department of Education oversees or facilitates will just be transferred to other departments, which would be good. But really, what is the plan? I think there should be a transparent plan before everything just gets axed. Honestly, for me, not having a plan to get my son to his baseball game makes me nervous, or a plan for a weekend trip makes me nervous. I don't like not having a plan for my next podcast episode. That makes me nervous. So not having a plan for some of the things that are currently handled for the Department of Education makes me very nervous. And as voters and taxpayers, citizens, and residents of the United States, no matter who we voted for or where we stand on the political scale, we are entitled to know about these plans. So what is the plan? Thank you for listening to the Journalism of Everything podcast. I am your host, Darice Smith, a freelance journalist with an unquenchable curiosity for everything. If you were absolutely wowed by this episode and or others, please subscribe. If not, subscribe anyway. And what is wrong with you? I'm on Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, and YouTube. And I have a website, journalismofeverythingpodcast.com. This has been the Journalism of Everything podcast. The best thing you can do is stay informed.